We're going to take a look at some of the insights from a book by Jaroslav Pelikan called Jesus Through the Centuries. It's been out about 5 years, and just recently, I guess more recently, came out in paperback as well. Jaroslav is a, as I mentioned last night, bragging, a classmate of mine. The closest we ever got, I suppose, is we lived in the same dorm. That's about as much as we really have in common. Jerry was obviously a marvelous student, Slovak person from the Chicago area. His dad was a pastor there. His brother Ted is a pastor out east in Pennsylvania. He's got a couple of great kids that I think one still is a classical disc jockey at St. Olaf in Northfield, Minnesota at their radio station, among other things. He, if I recall, he graduated, was married, and started teaching at Valparaiso on the same weekend in June of 1947 or something like that, you know, just so it goes. He's written prolifically, how many volumes, the Christian tradition.
Four or five
volumes. It's his real, you know, life's work. Big, huge things. Two of the volumes that have brought him world recognition for something. I mean, some kind of recognition. I was going to kick the guy. He used to write letters in Latin to John the 23rd, and they would write back and forth that way. They were close friends. He was that kind of a fellow. Also, a pretty lonely guy. I try to call him every time I'm in New York, just because I don't think he has a lot of friends around. He holds up in some kind of a place. But this was an effort of his to write more popularly his stuff. And by the way, he wrote a piece on the resurrection in the New York Times, the cover article in the magazine section, New York Times, that I thought was one of the greatest things done popularly for the audience of the New York Times. The audience of the New York Times, you know, is about 80% Jewish. And they asked him to write for that audience on the resurrection of Christ. It was a marvelous article. I got on the phone and thanked him for that one. He's really a neat guy. Teaches, still teaching at Yale. Should be retired or retiring pretty soon, I suppose. And the book is an effort to take a look after his study of history, sterling church history of Christianity, I guess, at Yale, not at the Divinity School, but at the university. This was an effort to look at what impact Jesus Christ has had on culture through the centuries, and to study that in a variety of ways, and culture meaning not only the arts, you know, art and paintings and literature and stuff, but the whole, a broader terminology of culture, I think, anthropologically speaking, that includes, politics and government and economics and all of society, whatever it may be. And doing that by seeing what were the ways that the society, that would include people in the church and outside the church, talked about Jesus Christ. What were the symbols for that Jesus Christ? Or to say it another way, the image of Jesus Christ. For I assume you would agree that alongside of the dogma or teaching about Jesus through the century, there was also right alongside of that an image of Jesus that was sometimes informed by what the teachings were, but often informed more largely by what was going on in the society. Or to say it another way, I think we implied at least last night, that the questions being asked in a society, the things being sought, the way life and its end and its meaning was seen, caused people to look for certain things, and that they tended to find, Christians would say, not strangely enough, in Jesus Christ some answers, and therefore would view Jesus in that way. I listed the 18 titles of the chapters in the book and the centuries in the little circles behind them. And what I'd like to do is just say a little bit about each of those and then get some of your response to that, and then have a chance to talk in general about what those implications are from what is said by those titles that are given up on the page there. I trust that it's clear that when I chose the topic, the whatchamacallit God, I'm not at all comfortable with the word whatchamacallit, that I don't think we have a right to a whatchamacallit God, but I think that we treat our God often as a sort of a whatchamacallit God, and that it, as we said last night, it makes a lot of difference what you do call God, or what the image of God is, will shape your relationship to that God, and I believe as well that your relationship to the world in which you live. And so it does make an awful lot of difference. And what we tried to say last night is that there are more images available, and I would be trying to encourage the use of more of those, and that we ought to, by looking at this, what has happened through the centuries, I'd be hoping to show that we don't have to absolutize one way. By the way, I think one of the humanity expresses itself in us is our inclination to absolutize. We find something, some aspect, some way, something, and we make that it. And then we're, you know, everything else tends to be wrong. It makes it nice because then I got a right thing, and then all these other things are automatically wrong. That absolutizing tendency, which I certainly see in myself, is what I think we ought to be terribly wary about. Hanging on to whatever is absolute, but not to be absolutizing about other things. And I think this reflects that kind of a thing in the Jesus through the centuries. Starts off with the rabbi because of the influence of the Jewishness on both the New Testament and the understanding even of the tradition of Judaism, that Jesus first was known as the teacher, the rabbi. I think that we've lost a lot of that. I don't know that we always expect to be taught, or that we aren't open very well to teaching. And I guess I think that's why I'm always glad to see Ralph describe himself as a teacher, and that he does mostly Bible studies and teaches. He doesn't do much preaching. I think the rabbinical role of the church and the rabbinical role of Jesus, the rabbi, the teaching role, is a really important one. I know I've had fun with some of my rabbi friends who thinks that Protestant ministers especially are so dumb because they try to do everything. I'm a rabbi. I'm a teacher. That's all I am. If somebody wants to see me, they have to come and see me. I don't go out and see them. I'm a teacher. You come to me. I think it's a worthwhile emphasis, but also a little bit of tomfoolery, because I think they like it the way it is, too. At least some of my rabbi friends did. So the rabbi is one. The turning point in history, the early history then, began to see the significance of Jesus Christ in human history, that things were beginning to be able to be seen to be different because. So there was a knowledge of a turning point. So what was said about the apocalypse that was expected, that things were all supposed to change, and about ethics and about prophecy, was beginning to get some perspective. Is it really going to be the end of the world now or not? Is the significance of the life of Jesus mean that things are going to end or things are going to begin? An aspect of Jesus that hasn't really been done away with even for today. And the way Jesus' life story was told and was put together, and the way even history was beginning to be done, revolved around this turning point, namely Jesus Christ. And then the light of the Gentiles, the so-called pagan anticipation of Christ, Were others also expecting someone else who would change them? Not only the people of Judah, the Judaic background who were waiting for it, of the Jews, but also others, Socrates and Virgil. Is there something implied in Virgil that were something implied that was expecting some new light, light to the Gentiles? And then the way the missionaries began to really work out what kind of a message they carried to the people of the cultures that were around Christianity at time in the Roman world. So he got to, Jesus got to be known as the light of the Gentiles in that second and third century. And then also the King of Kings. This is when the transition is made to the Roman culture when Caesar becomes, when Constantine becomes Caesar and announces that Jesus is the King of Kings. What are the implications in that, for instance, for the whole Roman Empire when the emperor suddenly begins to think differently about himself? The conflict between the lordship of Jesus and the lordship of the emperor being changed, and what are the implications for that? And then the rise of the so-called Christian Empire. Jesus is known for running things not only in heaven somewhere, but for running things here on earth as well. The King of Kings. Culture sees him, responds to him in this way. Obviously, this is all the basis of Pelikan's work and looking at the history, the broad reading that he's done. And I'm sure maybe someone else with a kind of broad reading, certainly not I, would be able to say, well, yeah, maybe, but there's something else. But I think for the quality of the person, the quality of the work that he's done, these are probably pretty reliable symbols or images that he draws out of longer periods of time. And then the fifth, the cosmic Christ, in the third and fourth centuries, Christ is seen as a new structure for thinking about everything, how reason is used, how the mind works, and especially the understanding of the Logos in John's Gospel, the Word, that Jesus Christ is the Word, and how that has implications not simply for church folks and religious people and even church and state relations, but for the whole cosmos, that Jesus is seen as giving perspective, a way of holding things together that is much broader than anything that had been said about Jesus broadly in the culture before that time. Obviously, those of us would say, yep, that's the kind of stuff that Paul was talking about and others were talking about in the New Testament. It got to be a facet of what was called Christianized Platonic philosophy that got to be seen, that Jesus got to see Jesus as the cosmic Christ. And jumping to the 5th century, Jesus is more known as the Son of Man. And here the St. Augustine is really helpful to the church, and others would say, you know, hindrance to the church in many ways. But the incarnate Son of God as the revelation is both the promise of human life and the power of God, according to some Christian psychology and anthropology that's worked out mostly by Augustine. And so the Son of Man focus about Jesus, not so much the divinity, not so much King of Kings and other, but the Son of Man. And in eighth and ninth centuries, the true image, the movement into the Eastern Church, the Byzantine art and architecture. Jesus is the inspiration of this, and although it started out in a place that images of God weren't that popular, now he becomes the focus for a whole rich field of icons and all kinds of artistic and metaphysical meanings of this 8th and 9th century. Whole Byzantine reflection that some of us enjoy, I'm sure more than others, but an unquestioned aspect of Jesus through the centuries. And then Christ crucified. In the 10th and 11th centuries, for reasons I don't understand, and I'd like to, I don't know if I want to read more about it, but I'd like somebody to tell me more about it, how the cross of Christ became a critical aspect. One of the things that Pelikan does in his book, each one of the chapters starts with a different kind of cross from all through the history. At the beginning of the page, and all these are identified, Celtic and whatever, all that they are. And here, the cross in literature, in the 10th and the 11th centuries, the crucified Christ is focused on as power of God and wisdom of God in the middle in the Middle Ages. Power of God coming from that cross, even in battle. The cross goes out front and is seen as having miraculous power just because of the cross. The finding of pieces of the cross, all of that's going on at the same time. And so metaphors for the saving work of Christ are erupting more in this 10th and 11th century connected with the symbol of the cross. In the 9th century, then, the Benedictine definition of love for Christ is focused. The monk who ruled the world is the monastic conquest of the church. In the medieval Western society, as people were seeking to escape, seeking to find more depth in the mystery of Christ, and Jesus is even portrayed then as like the monks who are the most religious people of the time. In the 10th, number 10, the Christian and non-Christian sources of Christ mysticism. The sacred and profane love in the allegorical interpretations of the Song of Songs got to be a really tough aspect of it. Most people, I think, most scholars today say that it was originally a story about two lovers, a man and a woman. But it was allegorically seen in those days, and so by the time, they're not even sure whether it was seen that way, maybe Ralph would even have opinions about this, before it got into the Old Testament canon, the Jewish canon, or not, whether it was exclusively allegorical or not. But that mystical approach of a relationship of the bridal and bride and bridegroom relationship was the focus of this particular period of time. And then in the 13th and 14th century, the rediscovery of the full humanity of Jesus through Francis of Assisi. That Jesus' humanity as the inspiration for the demands of the recovery, the transformation of the society and the institutional church. When Assisi, Francis of Assisi, makes his impact by this wondrous movement that he brought about in the 13th and 14th century. And so Jesus is known then for that divine and human dimension. 15th, 16th centuries, the Renaissance, with its image of Jesus as the rebirth of the Christian gospel, the philosophy of Christ is seen in Erasmus and other humanists, and now Jesus is seen more as universal, not simply Christian, not simply church kinds of stuff, but again seeing the universal aspect of it. And then in the Reformation period of the 16th century, the mirror of the eternal, this is a phrase that Pelikan uses as a mirror. He talks about the beautiful, the true, and the good. That's his introduction, and making an allusion to Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life. And that in this Reformation period, Christ is the mirror of the true in the new vernacular language that comes, especially through Luther, as the mirror of the beautiful in the Reformation art and in the literature of the Catholic Reformation in Spain, and the mirror of the good in the Christian politics of Calvin and the Reform movement. And so this mirror of the eternal being reflected in art, literature, and government and society is the way Pelikan describes that 16th century. And again, another aspect of it on number 14, the Prince of Peace, because this is the time of the Reformation and the wars the wars of religion. The just war business grows up during this time, and the Crusades as holy war are sanctified by the name of Jesus during this time. And yet, at the end of this era, comes a resurgence of pacifism out of the same Jesus. So Prince of Peace here with almost a quotation mark around it for part of the period, because it's in the name of the Prince of Peace that you go out and beat people and kill people into subjection, and at the same time ending up with a strong resurgence of the pacifism. 15, the 18th century, the teacher of common sense, the quest for the historical Jesus, when people began to say again, we got to get back and see what he really was like in the 18th century enlightenment that took place then. The effort to go beyond or even behind the Christ of dogma to the systems of morals that Jesus represents, part of that whole enlightenment period. And so Jesus is known now as in this period, the teacher of common sense. Number 16, in the 19th century, the idealism of philosophy in the 19th century and the romanticism in art and literature, they protest this orthodox rigidity of the past and the rationalist, especially the 18th century, banality that was not very deep, was trying to make it too easy. Their portrayal of beauty and sublimity in the barb of the Holy Spirit. Jesus is known as the poet of the Spirit. And in 17th, perhaps more obvious to some of us, in the 19th and 20th centuries, from Tolstoy to Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, the use of Jesus' prophetic opposition to economic and social injustice of his time as the dynamic for revolutionary change in the ordering of human relations, both public and private. And we, I guess, are a little more comfortable in seeing all of that because it's a part of our own time. And finally, in the 19th and 20th century, Pelikan summarizes as Jesus as the man who belongs to the world with this unprecedented circulation of the message of Jesus through these two centuries into Asia and Africa. The relation of Jesus and other teachers of the way, as Jesus is put, if you will, related to, but maybe even on a par with other teachers of the way, and that Jesus is a world figure in a way right now that may or may not continue forever, but that he no longer belongs, in Pelikan's view, just to the church. As for your reactions about it, but the point being, for me, in the whatchamacallit God that I'm talking about, is how each century sought different things, responded in different ways. And again, if my cause is any value, I'd say I think that's what's going on today in the things that are happening among us and around us, in the Christian faith and in other faiths as well, and that I don't think there are simple answers to it, like if we change this, then that'll work. No way. But that we ought to be open to responding to whatever these questions are in the best of our ability, connection with, and for me in some kind of commitment to the tradition, also to find ways to let Jesus be seen more clearly among us by those of us in the church as well as outside, as having some connection with all that's going on around us. But what's your reaction? Eh? Got any feelings about that or ideas? Yes.
One of Luther, The Mirror of the Eternal, I read this book a long time ago, so yeah. I may not have this fresh, but my question is this. If I think of Luther, when it comes to Christ, doesn't he have a kind of a Christ crucified.
Yeah, he would
emphasis.
Yeah. I would have added that to that section too. I think he backed up more to see not only Luther but the reaction in the church and the others as well, and not
so he's
say that
all of the 16th
yeah,
century, and
rather than the
Reformation
by itself.
A Luther's Reformation, a German Reformation.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And because it seems that at that point Luther seems to be very medieval.
Yeah.
I think that must have been strong in the monastery. I don't think he ever got out of it.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Somebody else.
You probably already said this.
No, go.
But. How did this thought, what you may call it, God, come to be?
It came to me from some of the arguments that are going on about what we call God, and does God have to be called in only a certain way? And on the one hand, I hear and see people and read things in which they can say anything they want with a whatchamacallit God. And the other people who are reacting very strongly to that and say, absolutely not, you can only talk about God in certain ways. You must talk about God this way. For instance, you must say, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or you haven't captivated what has been given from the past. So I was trying to get at that moving back and forth. I don't think it's legitimate, as I said before, to have a whatchamacallit God, because it makes a lot of difference what you call God. But my second part of that is that I don't think we're limited in what we can call God, because the scriptures is filled with ways, various ways of calling God. As I said last night, 50 different images for God in just in the book of the Psalms, that we ought to be expanding the way we do that in some commitment to the tradition. So that's, the origin is with me.
Well, I am wondering, I sat at a meeting about a year ago,
mm-hmm.
where was several meetings, and what I especially noticed was the people in this meeting, percentage-wise, didn't know at all who God was. And as I have listened, and when I first saw the title, I have wondered if it comes from that many people today don't know a personal God.
That certainly
they
is.
They have not accepted Jesus, God, and the Holy Spirit. It's beyond, they're out of it. They're not with it. They don't accept it as really.
I think that's certainly part of it. For me, the other side of that is the people who know God, who pretend to know God too well, who've got God figured out, and that when something happens, they say, God did that in ways that I can't even accept. So, I mean, I think the battle is not only that there are people who don't know, but there are people who know too much. And now, the twain shall not meet, and a lot of us, perhaps in between these things, are not heard well. Go ahead.
I guess what I'm saying is I was simply baffled that I could be sitting with a group like this who I really very much felt and they had not accepted God, and they did not know God, and they were not a, and that is what I got from. I was very surprised.
I know lots of people like that. I hang around with people like that. I like to hang around with people like that because I learn from them. When I was in campus ministry, most of the people I dealt with were not connected with the church consciously and determinately.
So what do you feel you learned?
Oh, what it is that they're reacting against when they say I've decided against it, for one thing, the very things we're talking about now. For instance, the way sin is used. The way the word, for women, the way the word servant is used, because they are slave, to become a slave of Christ. I taught that that's what we are to become, but I didn't have to use the word servant or slave. When people said, I don't like all this emphasis on sin. By the way, I hear this in Lutheran circles more than other places, that there's too much emphasis on sin. And then when I would simply talk about deception or self, if they've ever been deceived, or if they've ever deceived themselves, as an entree to understanding sin, all the people said, oh yeah, of course, I go through that. And I said, you know, that might be what we're talking about here and can move on to better understanding something. But there were turn-off words, and I'm not defending these people, you know, these people who tell me I got too much religion when I was young. I was around when a lot of what I believe is both the power and the forgiveness and the richness and joy of Jesus Christ. I've often said earlier in my life, I hung around too much with people who believed too much.
It seems to me that if we follow the pattern that's here, a conception that people have of Jesus is a conception which mirrors their own culture.
Yeah.
If the next question would be, how does what we have in the documentation, the biblical documentation of Jesus, how does that challenge what is there? They're in the culture. Let's take, for instance, number 5, which you have there, the cosmic Christ.
Yeah.
Now that Christianity becomes the big time religion in the Roman Empire, and people become baptized eventually to be a citizen of the Roman Empire, you have to be a Christian. Was there anything at that point from the biblical vision that was giving a different image?
I didn't find him doing that, in, at least as I recall.
In the literary, he must have also had here in the 17, where they think of this state, which is difficult to talk about.
Whether he did or not, I think that is an important dimension for us constantly to be working at. And the very way that we can confront what's happening, for instance, in our own society, I think is not limited to the way we have expressed the tradition, but I think the tradition brings things that we can find ways to see that it confronts. I don't hear very much. I heard a sermon not too long ago on, I think it was about greed, I recall. I can't remember everything about it, but it had a lot to do with stewardship. And it was on the same day that the mall was opening in our area. And not a word was said about the mall. And I think a mall is a symbol of American greed. I really do. But how do we confront that? That we can train our children, for instance, to be mall buffs. And let them grow up thinking that the only way to enjoy yourself is to spend money. And it's right there, we vote for it, we'll pay money to bring a mall in and everything else, but nothing is said by it. It seems to me there's a way of taking what we find in this book and certainly what we find in scriptures to reformulate ways of dealing with consumerism, if you want to use that kind of a phrase. That is such a part of our life, and that people are more aware of and more committed to than any baptismal covenant I've ever heard of. They will be unhappy if I cannot buy. I will be discontent if I do not have a pension. I will be angry with God if I don't have health insurance. How do we speak out to that kind of a thing? Yeah.
This is a more immediate reaction, cool. But I think there are examples of, I will be angry at God if I do not have a pension, if I do not have health insurance. But then how do you counter that with practicality of, I mean, if you don't have either, you know,
sure.
If you don't have either of those, you could end up in an extremely precarious situation and
might even die.
I wouldn't be angry with God, but I'm sure
I'd
be angry with society.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't see it as anger towards God, but it's the manner that the expectations of society. Of course you have to have these things, and you have to spend the whole first 50 years of your life working towards this thing so that you make sure you are safe and protected.
I certainly have questions about that. Oh yes. Again, see that's a very apt description of our society. I think you've taken a century and say, yeah, if it's like that, now what do we do? In practicality, as they would have said in the Crusades. Well, if Crusades are what's going on now, what do we do? And if we are going to be conscripted, we better go. You know. We say that was terrible. They went out and killed people to make them friends of Jesus. Is it possible that there might be something wrong with the way we see all of that? Is it possible there may be something wrong that we want to live as long as we do? Is it so bad to die? Is the worst thing that can happen to die? I don't know.
No, we don't want to die by inches.
You mean like the people of India and El Salvador and all the other places who are doing that today?
And I think each chapter builds on the one before, and although there's a new emphasis, you never lose the one before. And I was just looking at number 14, the Prince of Peace, and thinking, how wonderful. There's a little more of that retained and being built on, until eventually we get to the culture over there, that the Christians of the world agree that they will not kill each other.
Sure they do. And how that grew out of the fact that Christians were not peaceful, they were warring people, and that they learned from that. It was out of the mistakes, if you will, of the sins of that war. And that we might have to learn the same.
And that they might even have kept it clear to what St. Francis stood for.
I don't know if I didn't try to answer your question, but I think that does describe an age in which we are. And if we say, well, now the absolutes are, pension, whatever it may be, I mean, for our society, we're only talking about our society, we're only talking about a percentage of our society. It's a large percentage of our society does not have pension and health care. And then the Christians say, oh yeah, but for me, that's a must. It doesn't make any difference about anything else, but I'll do that. Well, is that where the challenge comes in? That the Christian faith comes up against the way a society, an age, sees.
I understand what you're saying, and I agree that the lack of those societal expectations should not be anger towards God. Why don't I have this? Why don't I have money to go spend at the mall?
Civilization makes very little progress. The more humane and cultural and civilized things, until the daily needs are taken care of.
Right. Yes?
It seems to me that speaks towards the positive part of living in the community, too. Because I think you don't feel the pressure for some of those things when you're living in the community and the support of other humans to help nurture you through the needs that you may not be able to provide for yourself.
If you've got equals, you don't have anything else to desire. You know, there's nothing that you think there's nothing to think of somebody else has more or less. On the same level, caring for each other and sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My problem with this question, Elmer, is
go ahead.
I don't have a pension.
You don't have one?
I don't have a pension.
Yeah.
And when I leave home, I want a medical insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, Sally, it's very nice living in community and having a roof over my head.
Yep.
But nobody's been able to tell me the name of a community I can go to when I leave here. And I've also only heard this question raised, and it's been raised once or twice in this country, is this the way Christians? I've only heard it raised by people who have medical insurance and have pension.
Sure.
Right? Nobody's been up here this summer from the streets of Seattle to address us on what it's like to have no pension. No medical insurance.
Exactly. I'm sure they would, my knowledge of those people, which is not great, would say, I don't have an answer to it, and I would dearly want it. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't answer the question. And I do, I say, I have a pension. I do have medical insurance, and I'm talking about that. And I'm talking about what I feel as discomfort about that. Not to believe that has led me to stop it, but I say, there it is. And the same as I say for, you know, the problem of evil in the world, I don't have an answer for it, but I don't want to stop bumping up against it somehow, because there's something there. I don't know all that can be done. I don't have the answer to say, well, what do you do about reality then?
In third world countries, there are no pensions and there is no health insurance. And what they do is what we Americans criticize so greatly. They have children. And they live in community, a family community, and the expectation is we have children so that when we get old, they will take care of us. And yet we sit over here and are very critical of them with all these children, and what's happening, why there's so many children, why don't they practice
birth control.
But that's been their answer. But their life is not one that we would readily want to adapt, because we're not willing to live as most people in third world countries will.
Someone else? Yes?
I'd like to look on to what you said about not being angry with God. I think ultimately people would get angry with God, not just in religious society. They think they're doing a wrong deal. And they think that somehow or other, if God is really taking care of the world the way he should, that they wouldn't be left without those things, whatever he's had. So there would be an envy of those that have it, and not only envy, a grudge and a hatred. And I think it would be almost pathological for religion not to let them express their anger, their concern. I just gone through that myself. I didn't take care of these things, medical insurance. I guess I saved a little, but until I just need months. And then how can you, they say, well, you should have long-term insurance. I suppose if you drive a car, you're going to have an accident if you get older, you're going to have problems. So maybe you should have it. But the insurance, and there happened to be an association for Luther. He was a nice guy, but he was dead wrong. He simply said, you have to protect your heritage and all this and that. Really, it doesn't bother me if we didn't have so much of it going for military and foolish things that society and the taxes would get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this personally, that's just my view. So this is not a personal thing, not partly because, never could live high on my logs all my life, and so I've been, have been frugal, so I think I can be frugal at being fool.
Yeah.
But I think that eventually it's going to be a God problem, not just only a social problem.
It's strange, but those of us who are committed to Jesus Christ in all kinds of ways, if a child of ours dies, how often it can immediately be, it's God's fault. God let it happen, or God, you know, somebody will say God wanted it to happen, or whatever, or at least to blame. Or how come God didn't stop it, protect it? What? And the old question of why me? is essentially a God question. Why isn't God protecting me? Why isn't God taking care of me better? So I think it can often happen. Surprisingly, you would say, well, quote, we know better, but the emotions that come by the time I get are often overwhelming.
It seems like that's a bad thing either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's so many people, oh, you can't be mad at God.
No.
Well, that's all rubbish.
True. Sure. You know? Psalms are filled with that, and certain other parts of Scripture too. Mm-hmm. The anger towards God.
Speaking of that, I remember a speech by, or quote by Elie Wiesel, who said, you can be angry with God, or you can live at peace with God, but you cannot live without God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's
sure. Do any of these titles up here appeal to you more than others, or for your own sake, or where you are today, or any of those? Or are they all pretty old hat? What's the closest to where you are today? Any one of those?
Is there something wrong with you if you want to keep all of
it? No. you can make up your own rules. Go. Okay.
Well, they'll obviously be going to be attracted to me one more than another.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I wonder if we'll keep coming up with new, you know, like you refer to building on these, we'll keep coming up with new images, or if we'll go in a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I find attraction to more of the spirit essence or the cosmic Christ, or you know, I think we tend to lose a lot of the the richness of the mystery and the cosmos or whatever. It's just the
poet of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, the unknown and the deep, earthy, dark, hidden areas of the spirituality of being a Christian, and I would hope that we would find some sort of cycle in this and find a way back to that, as opposed to just kind of a cut and dry Jesus story.
Mm-hmm.
There will always be plenty of unknowns, no matter how much we try not to have them.
For sure.
And also, if these are these grew out of the culture of the time, that I don't think we'll ever relive those identical kinds of cultures. We'll go on to others, but it doesn't seem as though we're going to repeat.
Maybe not exactly, but I think there are tendencies in histories that repeat themselves.
Could a computer come towards that? Of mystery of some kind. I don't know. Maybe not. I'm just saying it. But in this kind of age, or the information kind of stuff, this business, you know, you fax down to the deli for your hamburger or something like that, you know. Well, would that kind of strangeness be something that leads somewhere? I don't know. There's certainly, I know I got in trouble once with the president of the Missouri Synod for saying there is something new under the sun. The scripture said there wasn't anything new under the sun. And I think there are quite a few new things.
The resurrection was the new under the sun?
Yeah. So.
Are there any of these titles, I missed the beginning, are there any of these titles that Jesus actually applied to himself?
No, these are simply Pelletan's perception of looking at the culture, broadly understood culture, and saying this is how Jesus was imagined and written about and talked about and portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not
these are
no.
the image Jesus presented of himself.
No. Mm-hmm. And he said alongside, maybe you heard me say that alongside of the dogma of Jesus, the things that Jesus said and the things that are said about Jesus, formulated, is always the image of Jesus, and he was dealing with the image of Jesus in the culture. Yes?
In connection with what Ruth said, I think that's absolutely right, that
our time is unique for us. On the other hand, I guess as a scholar in me, if I go back and see, you know, what did the Francis of Assisi say, and look at the art of that time, and so forth, then I kind of challenge the present view that I have today, and then I kind of analyze it, and I think it helps in some way by challenging what I ordinarily would think. In that sense, the past can be, we don't absolutize it, but it really helps a lot.
But we say that history, we all say history repeats itself, and you can really see this, but still.
No, I don't think it repeats itself. I agree, yeah. I think we just learn from the past.
Yeah.
If we think that it's all on its way to a future that God is, the future of the risen Christ, mm-hmm. then we wouldn't just have the idea that it's cyclical, it yeah. repeats itself.
Well, tomorrow, in the search for some more images, I want to pick up some things that Terry Fredheim has said, both in his book and in the lecture that I heard on the vulnerability of God, the changeability, if you will, of God. Is God all set, completed, finished, done, and then watching it all go on? Or is there some interaction between the creation and God? I want to talk a little bit about that. That'll deal a little bit with prayer, to be sure, and with grief and suffering as well.